House Committee on Civil Law will come to order. Chair recognizes a quorum. Can I have a motion on the minutes? Minutes have been moved. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Representative Rosenthal, you ready to go on House File 1051?
Sure.
Okay, please take the chair. Representative Rosenthal moves that House File 1051 be recommended to pass and sent to Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. Representative Rosenthal, we have no amendments pre-filed to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. This is a crime victims bill. It's pretty simple. It has three basic groups. It sets protections for victim notification data. It clarifies language about harassment and changes it to stalking, and establishes a restitution working group. And I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you so much. My name is Kelly Moeller, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Alliance on Crime. And we seek to improve the criminal justice system's response to crime victims. I'm going to talk just very briefly about the restitution working group aspect of this bill. When I joined the Alliance a little over a year ago and talked to our member programs about what was most important to them and to victims and what concerns they had, restitution was really at the top of everybody's list. And I've gathered sort of an informal group from each judicial district to look at some of the issues concerning restitution. I won't describe some of the issues unless you have questions about that, but I just want to emphasize that restitution is very important to victims. It restores them to the position they were in financially before the crime. And research has also shown that it's important to offenders. It's part of the rehabilitative process, and it's also a crime deterrent. With the idea of the working group here, we would invite key stakeholders to participate in this process, and we would look at best practices both and come back to the legislature both with recommendations for statutory changes and also best practices that could be implemented without legislative efforts. I really can't emphasize enough how important restitution is to crime victims and to the criminal justice process.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, my name is Suzanne Elwell. I'm the director of the Crime Victim Justice Unit in the Office of Justice Programs, Minnesota Department of Public Safety, and I'm here to speak to the remaining provisions of the bill. First, there's a provision in the bill to correct some statutes that have outdated references to the term harassment. In 2010, the legislature amended statute section 609.749, then called harassment, to strengthen the law and to make sure that emphasize that the behavior we were talking about was stalking. The legislation renames that section from harassment to stalking. However, outdated references to the old name still appear primarily in the crime victim rights statute. So these would just correct those outdated references. Another part of the bill is to fill the gap for stalking victims. One right currently given to victims of violent crime is a protection against employer retaliation for victims and their families who take reasonable time off to attend criminal proceedings and civil proceedings related to the crime. Currently, stalking is not included in the definition of violent crime under that particular crime victim right. However, notably, it is included in the definition of violent crime found within other statutes. And finally, there is a provision that would protect the data that is collected and used for victim notification purposes. The proposal will close the gap in protection for release notification. Currently, there are some protections on some of the data that is collected and used for notification, but not on all of those notification systems.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee? Representative Holbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can understand the classification on the victim, but can you explain more on page 1? Lines 13, the notice provided, why would the notice also be protected?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Elwell.
Representative Holberg, Right now, our systems allow for a victim to make a request to be notified of the release of an offender, and then that notice is provided. It would be important to keep that information private so that the offender, potentially, or others would not have the ability to gain access to that information about that request or the notice that was provided to the victim who is getting that notice for safety purposes.
And Representative Hobart?
Mr. Chair, again, I can understand the information about the victim, but if you are sending out notices about bad guys, why would the notice about the bad guy itself be protected?
Ms. Elwell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, the fact that the person has been released, the offender has been released from a custodial institution, would not be private. It is the notice that is provided to that particular victim is what is protected.
And Representative Holberg, does the automated system only provide notices to victims? In other words, do you need more language on line 13 after the word notice? Do you need to put in provided to the victim as opposed to all notices in the automated system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, right now the language, the services that are provided are not restricted to just victims of that particular crime. That anybody can make a request through our automated systems to ask for notice of the release of that offender, including witnesses, family members of the victims, criminal justice professionals. Anyone can register, and so this would provide protection on the notices that go out to anyone under those automated systems.
And again, Mr. Chair, I just think we have a matter of semantics here, but I agree that you shouldn't be putting out names of people that receive the notice. But the information contained in the notice itself, I think, should still be public information, unless I'm missing something here.
Ms. Elwell, is this language, and maybe staff could help us, but does it inadvertently privatize any information that is currently public, specifically in the notice itself? Is that your question, Representative Holberg?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Mullen? Or Mr. Gehring?
Mr. Chair, I think I'd actually maybe defer to the witnesses.
Okay. So Ms. Elwell, can you... Is there currently information? We in this committee are, of course, concerned about the public nature of data, especially that which is contained in this bill. Is there anything that could be construed to to privatize something that was not contained in your intent in the bill right now?
Mr. Chair, the language, the first clause does say identifying information regarding the person requesting information. So that's clear that the person specific information is intended to be private. And the notice itself is the fact that the notice goes out about the release of the offender. Is my understanding or belief under this language that the notice or the information about the offender's release is not privatized.
Okay. Well, what we're going to do is, this is my intent to send this on, Representative Holberg, but make clear to the next committee and judiciary, Representative Hillstrom is here, that if something comes up between now and then, we can address it there.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to, for the record, make sure that my concern is clear, is that I don't want any identifying information, mm-hmm. but if you are, say you are saying that there's a release of somebody, let's say that, and I don't know enough about this automated system to know exactly what you're sending out, but if there's information contained in the notice through the system that's actually public information about the bad actor, we need to make sure that that remains public and that it can't be identified as a part of the notice and that all of a sudden you have an inadvertent consequence when you're just trying to do a good thing.
Thank you. Other questions from members? Seeing none, then Representative Rosenthal has moved that House File 1051 be recommended to pass and sent to Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, testifiers. Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. Representative Hortman, House File 19.
It's our second time around. We're punching our bus ticket twice here.
Oh, is this the one that we came back with, Representative Hortman?
Yes. Mr.
Okay, Representative Hortman,
Chair,
go ahead.
I would move that House File 19 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register.
Thank you. And you have a DE2 amendment, Representative Hortman?
That's right. And at this time, I'd like to move the DE2 to get the bill in the shape I would like it to be.
All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay, why are we back here, Representative Hortman?
In a fit of good government, when we learned that there were some objections by certain banking entities and credit unions to the bill on the House floor, instead of doing the technical fixes that they wanted on the House floor, we came back to committee to do our policy work here. So I have with me this morning an attorney from J.P. Morgan. I was going to say Chase Bank, but I knew that was wrong. And he will explain the provisions of the DE2 that we just adopted and why we made those changes.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Michael Sampson, J.P. Morgan. The credit unions, as well as some individuals from a bank in town, contacted me after the first hearing in this matter and had a couple questions, mainly about definitions, also about forms. And so most of the amendments in the version that you've just adopted as the final version are designed to address those concerns. The first one is they asked us to clarify who a party is. In the current Minnesota statute, there's a definition of the term party. We wanted to make sure that an agent wasn't a party because parties have rights over accounts to change agency designations and so on. So the first change is Section 2 to clarify that an agent is not a party. The second change is on Section 6. One of the banks had some questions about the form language, so we corrected a couple things in the form to satisfy some clarification that they wanted. Section 8 was a request from the credit unions. Apparently, in the original version, all the parties needed to sign an agency form. They wanted to be able to specify less than all if they wanted to in their agreement, so we allowed that in the statute. The Section D of Section 8 was also designed to conform the liability protection provisions with the ones in the power of attorney statute, Chapter 523. So that's really just to harmonize that. And Section 9 is a new section we added to clarify something that came up in the Senate committee hearing. Does this just apply to multiple party accounts, or does it also apply to a single party account? And so Section 9 is designed to clarify that it applies to any kind of an account, single or multiple party. The form has to be acceptable to the financial institution or the one in the statute. That seemed a reasonable request. And the last section says that it's prospective only, so that any existing account agency forms that are out there at a bank or a credit union won't be upset by the statute.
Thank you, Mr. Sampson. Questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, then Representative Hortman has moved that House File 19 as amended be recommended pass and sent to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you, Mr. Sampson. Thank you, Representative Hortman. Representative Ward is ready to go on House File 573. We have three amendments, members, all prefiled from Representative Scott. Is that right? Those are your amendments?
Mr. Chair, I'll be withdrawing my amendments.
Okay, thank you. Representative Ward, welcome to Civil Law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My pleasure. I don't know that I've ever been here before, but very much looking forward to today. Mr. Chair, members, I'm before you today to ask for your help in solving a health care crisis for our school employees in the state of Minnesota. House File 573 provides a solution for rising health care premiums, huge out-of-pocket expenses, very high deductibles, and even total elimination of health care insurance for some school employees. Members, as a former educator for 34 years and negotiator for many teacher contracts, I witnessed firsthand all of these problems. Statewide health insurance has passed both bodies of this legislature three times in the past with very broad bipartisan support. House File 573 also has broad bipartisan support. Members, it has passed three times in the past because legislators saw and believed that significant savings due to a large purchasing pool could then be used by school districts for children's learning opportunities. School districts have experienced huge premium increases over the past two decades. House File 573 would provide long-term stability and predictability for insurance premiums. House File 573 would provide a governance that would manage a plan for all in the pool rather than having over 300 individually managed plans. School district employees, members, are not healthcare professionals, and as they try to make decisions on their individual plans, sometimes they make some mistakes. The health insurance pool management can be better understood and undertaken by the State Labor Management Committee that House File 573 establishes. It's also universal belief that contract negotiations would be expedited if health insurance plans design was removed from the bargaining table. House File 573 is a solution to the years and years of the health care insurance crisis for education employees. And members, it can happen now. Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to just give you some characteristic pieces of House File 573. House File 573 uses the Public Employee Insurance Program, or PEIP, as the vehicle for a mandatory statewide insurance pool that would cover more than 200,000 school employees and their families. PEIP is managed by the Minnesota Management and Budget Department, which also, members, manages our CGIP insurance program. House File 573 would continue local control. School districts and local unions would continue to collectively bargain cost sharing for premiums and out-of-pocket expenses, eligibility requirements, and other health arrangements, such as wellness programs, health reimbursement accounts, and flexible savings accounts. This changes where school districts buy their health insurance, rather than having over 330 individual school districts each taking time and money to hire insurance consultants to get insurance bids, examine the bids, and then make decision about where to get their insurance. The work will be done for them. They simply get their insurance from PEIP. Members, it is an efficient use of taxpayer dollars, and it provides more transparency. House File 573 establishes a labor management committee composed of an equal number of union and employer representatives to work with the commissioner of management and budget on major decisions affecting the insurance program and to study benefits, utilization, quality, and other issues. The committee and the commissioner must jointly agree to changes in plan design. House File 573 requires participation by school districts that provide health insurance or make contributions toward employees' purchase of health insurance. School district participation would begin January 1st, 2014. Members, there are currently 12 school districts in the state of Minnesota that do not provide any health insurance for their educational employees. House File 573 allows self-insured districts and fully insured districts with over 1,000 or more lives to opt out if the exclusive rep and the school board mutually agree. They decide to opt out, they would not be able to join the pool for 4 years and may be rated separately if they decide to join the pool later. Members, I have with me today some testifiers that are going to share with you why they believe House File 573 is important for all education employees in the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I'd ask that my testifiers be allowed time to give their testimony.
Thank you, Representative Ward. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Patty Lagos. I'm here today to tell you my story and the story of my district. I'm 42. I've been an educator in Minnesota for 19 years. I hold a bachelor's degree in German, a master's degree in teaching and learning, an additional licensure in English as a second language. I'm also pursuing my licensure as a principal. I love my job. I'm very fortunate to earn a decent salary and be the primary breadwinner for my family of five. My husband works seasonally in construction. He stays at home with our younger children during much of the school year. Due to his self-employment, my employer is the most logical place for us to obtain health insurance. Unfortunately, I'm embarrassed to say that my younger children and husband have never had health insurance because we cannot afford the extra $500 currently it would cost each month to pay for the cheapest family premium offered through my district. This option, which also brings with it a $2,000 out-of-pocket deductible, is not possible for us as $500 is more aptly used for part-time preschool tuition, food, and gas. We do pay $70 a month for my insurance, but even that comes with a $1,500 deductible. I have daily pain from carpal tunnel, tendonitis, and a rotator cuff issue, yet I don't go to the doctor due to high copays and deductibles. Our daughter was born with several health issues. She had surgery when she was 7 weeks old. She has a hole in her heart and a hemangioma under her nose, all of which should be checked annually, but haven't been because we have no insurance. My husband has a slipped disc in his back, and it causes him pain. He works less often due to this injury. Neither my daughter nor my husband have received their needed care due to our lack of insurance. At present, we owe about $7,000 for past medical bills. We have incurred upwards of $30,000 for my husband's and daughter's medical issues. Some was paid for aid that I applied for, and the rest was paid out of pocket. Right now, I make too much money to qualify for medical assistance, but not enough to pay for the high insurance costs through my employer. Our situation is a constant worry for me. It is truly hard to consider myself professional when I can't provide for my family's health and welfare, even at my highest career salary. My district is a mid-sized district, and it's limited to what they can do in analyzing and using the district's claims data because of its size. By collecting the claims data statewide, PEEP would enable us to set appropriate premiums, more appropriate premiums. This will also help to create a large pool that will stabilize the premiums and provide adequate benefits. PEEP will also be able to analyze the claims data, and create member education programs and wellness programs that would benefit everyone. It's difficult for a mid-sized district to do that right now. Please vote for this bill today so that all school employees, including me, can get more affordable health insurance, and my children, husband, and myself can get the care that we need. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for hearing me today. My name is Michael McKenzie. I've been a teacher for 24 years, most recently AP Economics at White Bear Lake High School. I'm currently the president and head negotiator for the White Bear Lake School District Teachers Association, as well as a member of the White Bear Lake School District Insurance Advisory Committee. This committee has members of all district employee groups. I want to tell you about our experience with PEEP in White Bear Lake, and specifically about the challenge of getting claims data. I've been a member of the White Bear Insurance Committee for more than 10 years. In that time, we've seen our health insurance premiums greatly increase, most years by double digits and some years by close to 20%. In addition, over the years, we've been forced to accept lesser coverage and increase copays in an attempt to control costs. Through my union work, I'm in contact with teachers around the state, and the story is the same wherever I go. When school districts talk about doing what they can to contain costs, what they're really doing is talking about containing costs for the district through shifting costs to the employees. When PEEP first became law, as our president of the local union, I decided to pursue a PEEP bid since our health partner's contract was expiring that year. Our district was very reluctant to provide the necessary data. They did not want us to include PEEP in our insurance process. They tried to convince us not to proceed at all. Then they blamed health partners for delays, threatened to charge us for the information that we needed, and generally dragged their feet for releasing any of the information we needed to get the PEEP bid. Eventually, they gave us the data after we pointed out we had a legal right to it, but only after we had to get our lawyers involved. As soon as we got this data, health partners moved into high gear. They immediately contacted me about meeting with them. When we met, They presented me a PEEP clone policy at very good rates in an attempt to keep our business. Through negotiations with them, we were able to secure some very important incentives for us to stay. They actually lowered our rates about 23% that year. They kept our coverage the same as it had been, which was slightly better than what PEEP was offering. They included favorable caps for the next 2 years, 6% and then 8%. They included a new basic policy that would have no monthly out-of-pocket premium cost for our employees. In the end, we ended up not choosing PEEP, even though they gave us a very competitive bid. However, just having the competitive bid from PEEP greatly helped us negotiate a favorable policy with Health Partners. In the first year alone, these changes saved the employees of White Bear Lake School District almost $2 million. This past October, Health Partners came out to our insurance committee again to present the policy renewal information. Since we had a 6% cap on increases, I was confident what our increase would be. Indeed, it was 6%. However, when they were justifying their 6% increase, their representative told us an interesting piece of information. He said their actuarial department figured our premium increase at 33.75%. And then he chuckled and told us not to worry. Even if we hadn't had the 6% cap, their marketing department always tries to stay under 20%, so we'd have probably gotten 2 17% increases. It feels like Health Partners was practicing a little bit of bait and switch to keep us with them, hoping that PEEP would somehow go away. Again this year, we've gone through the same struggle with getting claims data from our district. It took almost 3 months to get that accomplished for the second year in a row. I believe the current PEEP law served the White Bear Lake District and many other public districts well. I also believe the leverage we use in White Bear Lake to gain competitive rates is somewhat of a one-time deal. Seeking PEEP bids every year is not sustainable. It costs PEEP and its insurers. It's not right that it takes a bid from PEEP to get the other insurance companies to give us real competitive bids, and it's not a sustainable situation. The people who are saying that the current system of allowing PEEP bids is working are the same people who caused me to come and testify against their bill trying to take our PEEP rights away. Our current system is not working. The local union and the state union are working hard to provide adequate benefits and at an affordable price. We need your votes to help school employees all over the state fix this problem and give them access to an affordable insurance product. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. McKenzie. Questions from members? Representative Ward, I see some have other testifiers. Also, this, members, this bill is in front of this committee for Section 4, non-identifiable aggregate claims. So just so we can be clear that that's what we're going to be limiting things to, are you going to have anyone testify as to that section, Representative Ward, specifically?
Mr. Chair, no. The testifiers here today are totally about the whole PEEP bill. Unless is there one, Mr. Chair? Let me.
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, let me ask Ms. Allswager to come up here and clarify that for me.
I just want to ensure that, and I appreciate the testimony. It is good testimony, Representative Ward. I just want to ensure that we have controversial bills on the agenda.
Yep.
We want to make sure we get to go those. Ms. Allswager.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswager, Education Minnesota. I think that previous two testifiers really did talk significantly about the claims data. The others two have some comments about claims data. I will take my name off the list as testifier, and then I'll be available for questions. So I'm sure that they can try to keep their testimony pretty short and deal with some of the claims issues.
Okay, great. Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee members, good morning. Thank you for allowing me time to speak to you today. My name is Robert Daneker, and I'm a social studies teacher at South St. Paul Public School, Special School District Number 6. I'm also the president of the South St. Paul Teachers Association, Local Number 861. I'm here today to urge this committee, specifically in the legislature in general, to pass a public employee insurance program bill inclusive of school employer participation in the form of House File 573. Exactly 1 month ago today, three members of my local's political action committee visited our school district's local legislators at the Capitol and discussed, among other things, the public employees insurance program. At that time, it was our position that while the amendment of the current statute to include school employers was undoubtedly a wise long-term decision, we nonetheless retain short-term concerns over the bill. The South St. Paul Teachers Association has long held health insurance as our primary focus during biennial collective bargaining, and for good reason. We are proud of the health benefits that we have achieved and maintained during bargaining, and we were apprehensive to move towards a system largely unknown to us at that time that might have impacted the overall quality of health care that we have struggled to retain for so long. I'm here today to tell you that I was wrong, we were wrong, and our view of public employees' insurance program, inclusive of school employers, has changed. On Tuesday, February 26, our current health insurance provider informed our school district that they would bid to renew our policy with a 37.5% rate increase. Such an increase would equal an additional expense of up to $5,930.17 for an average family covered by our district's insurance. To add insult to injury, two other insurance providers declined to provide our district with a bid at all. A third declined to provide a formal bid, but informally communicated that if they were to bid, the increase over our current rate would be in the neighborhood of 55%. Our district has since received a second formal bid from another insurance provider, outlining a rate increase of 25.6%. While more modest than the first bid, the added financial responsibility passed on to a typical family covered by our district's insurance would be up to $4,643.34. The reason for these enormous proposed rate increases is threefold. First, our insurance pool is small. The insurance pool of South St. Paul Public Schools includes only 363 staff and retirees, and the total number of insured in the pool is 830 individuals. Second, our pool has suffered a rather high number of serious medical incidents, including multiple cases of cancer, some terminal, and various other significant maladies. Third and finally, it has become painfully obvious to us that the current method of school employers contracting for health insurance in our state is inefficient, outdated, and largely broken. As president of the South St. Paul Teachers Association, I can tell you that we identify with other suburban school districts and employees that, like us, place a high value on quality health insurance. Historically, our union and district have worked together to keep down health insurance costs. In fact, as a union, we have consistently negotiated small salary increases in order to better retain the value of our health insurance. We have been able to do so, as mentioned previously, up until now. The current model is simply not sustainable. What a mandatory statewide pool would provide to us is long-term consistent stability in insurance rates for school districts and educators. Mr. Chair, committee members, I ask you, please join us in supporting the inclusion of school employers in a public employee insurance program because it is predictable, it is dependable, it is fiscally sound, and because it is the right thing to do. Thank you for your time this
morning. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Daneker. Questions from members? Next testifier is Mr. Wilmus. Representative Scott.
Don't go anywhere,
Mr. Daneker. Do you have a question for Mr. Daneker?
Well, this might be for the author.
Okay.
I'm just wondering, Representative Ward, in Section 4 on line 5.27, when it's talking about this aggregate information, it says it gives a list on 5.26 of the data relating to school employees, group benefit sets, demographics, claims experience, and other data or information deemed by the commissioner as necessary to accurately and appropriately underwrite the risk. And I'm just wondering if you could elaborate on what, you know, that other information might entail. I mean, that's a pretty broad swipe there of information that the commissioner, I mean, he could deem almost anything to be necessary. And I'm just wondering if you have an idea that you could elaborate on that.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Representative Scott, thank you. That article deals with making sure that the data is received that, so that an accurate bid can be given for PEEP or any other bid for insurance. So if it whatever includes, as it says here, claims, past claims, experience, demographics, anything that relates to receiving an accurate bid for a insurance quote.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And Mr. Representative Ward, well, other than the things already delineated there, what things might that include?
Representative Ward.
Mr. Chair, I don't have that information from me, but maybe we can have Mr. Morocco from the actual PEEP organization address that.
All right, Representative Scott, if it's all right, why don't we have him come down when we finish with the testifiers?
Okay.
And you can answer that. Representative Scott.
I just want to be on record as saying the Hennepin School Districts, I've talked to them, that's the largest school district in our state, and they are very much opposed to this. It's going to cost them money. So while it's some of these other folks that have testified that it's costing them more money, you know, what they're doing, in my opinion, is taking away a choice from many school districts in order to, you know, spread the misery in a way. And also, Representative Ward, I just had a question, and wouldn't some of these people be eligible to be in the Health Insurance Exchange next year?
Representative Ward.
That's a great question, Representative Scott, Mr. Chair. And the actual state exchange that we just passed and hopefully will be signed into law, the school districts, the larger school districts, most school districts in the state of Minnesota will not be eligible to be in the exchange until January 1st of 2017. So we have 4 years, excuse me, 3 years of potential savings for the school districts in the state of Minnesota to apply that savings to the our classrooms. Anoka Hennepin, Representative Scott, I know was looking at significant increases into their health premiums this year in their health care, and my understanding was that you know, that this might be one of the things that could significantly help them. So I'm surprised to hear that. But to answer your question, most districts would not be eligible to go into the exchange until the year January 1st of 2017.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I spoke with the school board president last night, and this is what he told me, so I'm pretty sure that they're opposed. And, you know, in 3 years, no one will be able to opt out of this, am I right? So they wouldn't even be able to jump from PEEP into the healthcare exchange if they wanted to, if it was cost savings to them.
Mr. Ward.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. You are in the program, it's irrevocable, and you are in here, you know, forever. Because we believe, and I believe, and whoever Mr. Morocco is, they have showed stable, consistent premium increases in a well-managed pool. And remember, we're bringing in 200,000 lives into a pool that would make the rates much more competitive, while not cutting, eliminating benefits. As one of my testifiers already said, that's how insurance companies are able to compete and going into their reserves to have a one-time lower bid. And then once they retain that bid, then oftentimes they come back later with a significantly increased premium increase, as the testifier has also indicated. So,
Representative Scott,
Mr. Chair,
and Representative Scott, we have one testifier left. I'd like to get through that testifier, as well as we have one testifier requested to speak in opposition.
I'll hold my question.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Wilmus. Please begin your testimony, and please keep your comments limited to the subject matter of the aggregate claims data in Section 4.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matthew Wilmus. I live in Lewiston, a city in southeastern Minnesota, and I teach music at Lewiston Altura Public Schools. Limiting my comments to the aggregate data, my school district was very willing to work with the union and all educators in our district to get claims bids from multiple companies, including PEEP. The school district, although very willing to work with us, still had to get that claims data from Health Partners. Health Partners was very unwilling to cooperate with us, even when we had the school district and the teachers together asking for that data. Once we did get the data, we found PEEP to be the best program for us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for keeping it brief. Barbara Cox.
Hi, Barbara Cox from Health Partners, and I am not prepared, unfortunately, to speak about the specific incidents that were mentioned today. I don't work in sales and marketing, so I don't have information specific to those, but I do want to speak to the bill briefly and to the data provision. You know, the point of the bill is a mandate, and I am here to say that the voluntary system works. I've got an article that, again, I'm sensitive to the jurisdiction of the committee, but if I could just pass this out and you can read in your leisure. It talks about the Wisconsin school pool, which after 20 years allowed school districts to bid outside of the pool. And in the example of the Hudson School District, when allowed to bid competitively, saved $1 million a year. And the article states that this was for Mary. Very minor deviation between the old and new plans, including minor differences in copay amounts, $1 million a year. And I'm not an expert on the Wisconsin school pool. It may be a different pool, but the point is that choice and competition worked. And secondly, to the points about all of the changes happening now because of federal health care reform, I've got another document to pass out. And that just shows, it's probably not even a comprehensive list, but some of the many, many changes that are coming in the next few years, to the point that this may not be the best time to take on another big change, especially when you'll read in the bill, I think it's on line 5.2, as Representative Ward noted, this change, this decision to not opt out from school districts is irrevocable. Finally, I'll just speak again to the jurisdiction of the committee, and that is on the data provisions. We feel the language is really broad, that the information is any information that the commissioner deems necessary, and just ask that the committee consider tightening that language. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Cox. Questions for members of the committee for Ms. Cox? Seeing then, back to Representative Scott's questioning, line of questioning. Representative Scott.
Well, was the gentleman that could explain the
yes.
information necessary?
Someone from PEEP. Please identify yourself for the record, begin your testimony, or answer the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division. I oversee both the State Employee Group Insurance Program and the Public Employee Insurance Program that's being discussed here today. If the question could be rephrased, as I understood it, was what type of information do we look for? Is that
Representative Scott?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Morocco, yes. On line 5.27, 2.6 and 2.7, and any other data or information deemed by the commissioner as necessary.
Ms. Morocco.
Other than the things listed, what kind of things might that be?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I didn't write the language here, so I think it's intended to be sort of a catch-all for anything that we might need in terms of underwriting requirements. What I can tell you is that typically what we get is claims information. We're looking for enrollment information, singles plus one, things like that. We're looking for contract counts, how big is the group. We're looking for high-cost claims, so we can look for outliers or things that might lead to exorbitant claims, down the road. And we're looking for typically things that are listed in the summary plan description, which talks about the kinds of coverages that are covered and not covered. That is usually available through many public types of documents. And then we're looking at the premium rates. And in some cases, if a group is really small or they're having difficulty getting access to claims, sometimes we'll ask for like a health history questionnaire. We'll actually have the individual members. We have some groups of five individuals will come into the PEEP group, and so they're not necessarily in a position to get claims data. So we'll just simply have them fill out a questionnaire, and typically that's more demographic kinds of information, age, sex, things like that that we can use for underwriting. I would certainly defer to the health plans but my understanding would be is that's pretty typical of what any organization underwriting for healthcare would be. So I'm not sure if all of that was listed here in the language, but that's typically what we would look for in the PEEP program.
Scott.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Morocco. Well, some of the things you described to me could actually be it could go back to identifying a certain person, where you have a small pool, and you have, if you're looking at data, especially the outliers, as you said, maybe there's one person in that school district that had cancer, and so theirs was it stuck out like a sore thumb. You could easily identify that person by using that information. I just am not comfortable with this language. It's, as the previous testifier said, it's far too broad, and I think it's very problem-causing.
Well, that wasn't a question, Mr. Morocco. Do you have something you need to specifically address with respect to comments? Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. Just so that it's clear, we don't actually receive the identifiable information. We receive information about the group, but it's not we first of all at PEEP we don't see the information. We do have underwriters that we utilize, Deloitte Consulting, and the information that they're getting simply says that employee X has a certain condition or is a certain type of demographic. But in no shape or form does it ever say this is specifically the person. It wouldn't be able to be traced back to the individual, neither from us or even from our actuaries.
Mr. Morocco, I think Representative Scott understands that the point is in a small district they could be identified. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ward. I wanted to start by commenting that Ms. Cox's comments in her testimony highlighting the Wisconsin school pool and how competition and choice, just based on her example from the Hudson School District, has clearly worked. I thought that was just an excellent point. In fact, she said she, and I completely agree with her, that this might not be a good time, especially now my words, based on the seismic shifts that we are experiencing right here in Minnesota with the recent impending implementation of the exchange. And just the health care and health insurance roadmap that is changing in such a significant way. In fact, you mentioned that most school districts won't be eligible until January 1st of 2017 to participate. And back to the language on 5.2, that this program is irrevocable, this is really disturbing to me, that here we have something which many feel might be just fabulous, this new health insurance exchange. And school districts, once they opt into this, would be precluded from participating in this exchange. And that just seems really wrong to me. I'm just very concerned about it. In fact, I also echo Representative Scott's comments. I spoke with three of my four superintendents, actually twice over the course of the last couple of weeks, since this is the second time that I'm hearing this bill. And I've also heard from many constituents who are teachers in these school districts. And to a person, they are just highly disturbed by this piece of legislation. So I am very concerned.
Thank you for your comments, Representative Pugh. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pugh, it's actually they have to opt out. It's not opt in. But my question is for the gentleman from the department.
Mr. Morocco. Go ahead, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me what an inappropriate underwriting would be?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Holberg, no.
Well, members, maybe Representative Ward can help me. Representative Ward, can you tell me what an inappropriate underwriting would be?
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, no.
Well, members, on line 27 of page 5, we're going to give this broad data provision. I understand what accurately means, to accurately underwrite something, but I'm not sure what appropriate is.
Well, Representative Holberg, I think it's probably a rhetorical question. I'm assuming falling under the umbrella of inappropriate would be arbitrarily, would be one. That, would be an inappropriate method of underwriting. But if anyone can describe what the last word in the line of 5.27 would prohibit, an example of one, that would be helpful. Representative Ward?
Would you repeat that?
The question from Representative Holberg is that the demographics or data or information deemed by the commissioner is necessary to accurately and appropriately underwrite information. So therefore, what is left out of that? What is information that would be requested that would not be appropriate to use to underwrite?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, I think that anything that would identify somebody is in a, your initial question is about inappropriateness. I think anything that would be used to identify a person as they are looking to do a comparison bid would be inappropriate. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's what comes to my mind.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, the appropriate doesn't modify the data. It modifies the underwriting in your sentence.
Well, if we don't have an answer for it, and I think it's because it's...
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm trying to make the point. This has very broad data access, whatever we think we might need, and then it then doesn't even have a tight definition of the job at hand. So if it's broad data to accurately underwrite, that's one thing. If it's broad data to accurately and appropriately underwrite, I don't even know what that means.
Well,
I don't think I got an answer from the author either.
I don't know if there's a similar rules in underwriting or actuarial sciences, like there is in accounting with generally accepted accounting principles, but I think it would be something along those lines, appropriateness of underwriting or actuarial type of work. What is left out of that? I think that's the question, probably, or a component of the question that Representative Holberg is asking, but it would be handy if we could get that answer and get it back to Representative Holberg between these times. Do you have another question, Representative Holberg?
I do not.
Okay. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask Mr. Morocco and maybe the author as well on this language. I agree with Representative Holberg. It's pretty broad and very subjective to say deemed by the commissioner as. It doesn't even say that he or she has to reasonably deem it to be necessary to accurately and appropriately. It's just that what they subjectively deem. And I'm wondering, Mr. Morocco, I'm not going to propose a formal amendment here, but would it compromise the effectiveness of this section to simply say on line 5.27, or information reasonably necessary to, et cetera, get rid of the words deemed by the commissioner as? I'm not formulating a formal amendment here, but would that compromise the effectiveness, or do you think that the data gathering effectiveness, just to put in a more objective term rather than subjective term?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, yeah, I don't think we would have any concern. I mean, I think it's meant to be the list that is here is pretty comprehensive. There may be some situations where we're looking for some other piece of data that we're not aware of today. So I think that would be a reasonable test would certainly be appropriate.
And I understand. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand that this is aggregate data, too, notwithstanding the concerns that Representative Scott and Representative Pugh enunciated. I understand that generally this is aggregate data. I mean, if it's okay with Mr. Morocco, and if the author is okay with that, and if the chair, more importantly, is okay with that, then I would offer an oral amendment to that effect.
Go ahead, Representative Simon.
On line 5.27, the amendment would be to strike the words deemed by the commissioner as, and in place of those words, insert the word reasonably.
I think the amendment is clear enough without having to be... Representative Scott, you have a comment on the amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. And so I'm not an attorney, but is there a definition for reasonably? I mean, is there...
Well, Representative Scott, it would be a jury would determine that. So Representative Simon, you offered the amendment. Why don't you give your answer?
I think that's right, Mr. Chair. I guess my point is to just insert some more objective criteria here instead of one that seems to be really totally subjective, but it sounds like that's not going to be a problem. So that's really the aim. But as you said, Mr. Chair, reasonably is usually a finder of fact, whether it's a judge or jury would decide that.
And it would be up to a jury of peers to decide that, as opposed to if this were litigated, Representative Scott, a jury would just be asked the question, well, did the commissioner deem it necessary? And then that's the standard. Whereas instead, it's whether a jury deems it necessary. Okay, so I think Representative Holberg.
If I might, who at the onset makes that determination? So who is the, who determines whether or not, least you had an accountability factor in your old language, you had a commissioner, while the language was broad. I'm just curious who makes that determination in setting the data set of what's reasonable? Is that PEEP that's saying what's reasonable? Is that school district
Holberg
saying what's reasonable?
According to the amendment, it would be my understanding would be the person who had to underwrite the risk would request what they needed to do the underwriting, and if the person who had to submit the data balked at that and it got litigated, it would be up to a jury or a finder of fact to determine whether or not this was really necessary to do the underwriting. Representative Simon, is your assessment similar?
I would agree, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
And so if I might, would a plan be able to assert that it wasn't reasonably necessary and then have a court battle prior to coughing up the data?
Yes, Representative Holberg.
All right, thank you.
Okay, to this? Representative Yusser, you have a comment to this?
I had a question, point? Mr. Chair.
To this point?
Yes.
Go ahead, Representative Yusser.
Does this data become public data then?
Who is that question for, Representative Yusser?
Anybody that could answer it, I don't know.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Yusser, no. It doesn't become public data.
We're still on the amendment then. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Correct me if I'm wrong, but once that becomes, to Representative Urso's point, once this goes into the court of law, would that data then not be public because it would be in a public arena in the court?
Who's that question for, Representative Howe?
Somebody that's an attorney, because I'm sure not.
Well, Representative Ward, can you answer that question?
Mr. Chair, the actual data wouldn't be public. The determination of the factors, you know, would be public, but not the actual information.
That sounds right to me, Representative Howe. So, to the amendment as stated on line 5.27, strike the language deemed by the commissioner as and insert the word reasonably. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Okay, Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just thought I would like to help to clear up a little bit this question that keeps coming up about the exchange versus what we're talking about here. And just to say that the exchange is a method by which people who have to buy insurance in the individual market and the small group market can have a little more buying power, especially as we've passed the exchange now. It's to help those people have a little more buying power than they have if they're just on their own to try to buy a policy, which is the case now. What this does, that in no way tries to replace the buying power of a large pool. So if we're all, you know, doing really well, the cost of insurance under the exchange should start to become more like what you can get in a large pool. But it was never intended to replace pools that employers would establish or like what we're talking about in this bill. So I just want to kind of try to clear that up because this keeps coming up of how the exchange will impact this. It really shouldn't. It is meant to give people more like what employees should be able to get under a pool like this. So I don't know who handed out this sheet about the federal health care reform, which lists a whole lot of things, and I suppose the point of this is to make it look like, oh my gosh, look at all these changes. But when you look at this, down about the middle of the first page, you've got Health Insurance Exchange, and it tells you exactly this. Minnesota Insurance Marketplace for individuals and then small employers, 2 to 50 until 2016. So that in no way, unless you've got, perhaps the very, very small school districts, I don't know if there are any that actually have only 50 employees, but if you had a very teeny tiny little school district, maybe those people could now buy in the exchange and they would be better off than not having an exchange. But they certainly would not be better off than being able to participate in a large pool where the risks are spread and where the administrative costs are so much less. And so I think if we get to the point where the exchange actually competes with these large pools, then the exchange is doing exceptionally well. I hope we get to that point, but I don't think we're getting there anytime soon.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And by the way, I do represent some teeny tiny school districts. But a question to Mr. Ward. I understand, or Representative Ward, I understand that over the course of my life, that the government is basically against monopolies. And the way I'm kind of looking at this is, wouldn't this be giving PEEP an exclusive for underwriting and creating a pseudo-monopoly for this insurance?
Representative Ward. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, in my opinion, no, I don't believe this is a monopoly, because there's other venues out there available for people to look at. And so this simply says we're going to create a large pool, as Representative Lee being so accurately stated, that is going to spread the risk out, that is going to be more competitive, that is going to make sure that the benefits are there for the insured folks. So I don't think it's creating a monopoly.
Representative Anderson. Thank you. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just one last question for the author. My thought is that if this is such a critical piece of legislation and it's so urgent and to do this now, and that given all of, you know, what is changing here, this impending insurance exchange and just healthcare in general, and that employees or individuals can't get out once they're in, you know, which could in fact preclude a participant's, you know, involvement in the exchange. To Representative Liebling's point, the exchange may offer more choice for an individual, you know, who knows. So, you know, I'm just wondering why is it so urgent that this happen now, given all of the change that we're about to experience as a state? And my second question is, given that, might you not be concerned that you'd be precluding participants from considering other choices once they're in?
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Pugh, I think I've answered that once already, but I'll answer again. Is the fact that why now is because this gives immediate possible savings to our school district as found in a local impact note. And many people have talked about the local impact note as being, outdated information. The fact of the matter is, the local impact note does show significant savings, no matter what that number is. So there are significant savings that can happen for our school districts in the state of Minnesota, all school districts in the state of Minnesota, right now. So that's why now. And Representative Pugh, I also believe that through this pool, there will be solid benefits, premiums stabilized. PEEP and CGIP have a management pool that has a managed competitive market is internal and does show good results. They operate with very lean administrative costs. I believe that it is a product that is going to provide health care coverage that is quality health care coverage and affordable health care coverage for our school district employees.
Thank you. Representative Scott, members, we have Representative Scott, Representative Neuberger, Yaruso, and Howe, and Representative Holberg. A note that we have 23 minutes left, members, for some pretty controversial bills. This bill is here for the aggregate claims data. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where's this bill going next?
This is going to State Government Finance, Representative Scott.
And will it be stopping at Education Finance somewhere along the way?
Representative Ward, did you already go there, or are you going to go there?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, no, because it's going to State Gov Finance, because it has impacted PEEP, but doesn't impact the PEEP program, but not the local school districts with a cost.
And Mr. Chair, I'd just like to request a roll call before I forget. Thank you.
Roll call is requested. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just been sitting here listening to this. I've been kind of going over this since last fall, trying to keep an open mind. So I've been in contact with school board members and also some of my superintendents. I have yet to find anyone, any of my superintendents, that support this. The overriding consensus is that this will be very expensive. That it'll to the school districts, and I want to march this out, because I think what we're not doing is we're not looking ahead. If this is irrevocable, and this becomes a problematic cost issue for school districts, what you're going to have then is school districts who are going to come up short of funds, to fund their insurance programs. So when they do this, then they're going to have to come to the public, and they're going to have to levy for more money to cover these costs. So now we're faced with a choice. We can either have a de facto tax increase, which would be massive in some of these districts, or you're going to be looking at cutting teachers, because if the levies don't pass, then you're going to be looking at cutting staff. This is something that doesn't seem to be thought through very, very well, and I think that this discussion needs to be had, because this program is irrevocable. If you get to a point where every cycle that you have to levy for more money because your PEEP program demands that it goes up, it's either levy for more money or cut more staff. I don't think that serves our educational interests. And the other thing, when I was reading through the bill, that the board here that would pretty much oversee this, it would all be appointed by different union entities. This looks like a program. This board would have enormous leverage, given the data access as well, over health insurance companies. Kind of turning to what Representative Anderson was saying, this kind of creates a perfect monopoly the way that I read this bill. And I think that these issues need to at least have a little light shed on them.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just would like to direct people's attentions to lines 5.3 through 5.6. Many of the concerns that have been raised in the last few minutes are covered in that paragraph. Anoka Hennepin could opt out because they surely have more than 1,000 people insured in their district. Anybody that gets a bid that's less expensive than this could opt out. And the thing that isn't covered in that paragraph that has been discussed is any individual can always waive the insurance that their employer gives them. I've done that many times because I've had a complex series of employment situations in my lifetime. And so there is absolutely nothing in this bill that would prevent an individual from doing whatever they wanted to outside of this.
Thank you, Representative Russo. And I remind members of the committee, we're not talking about lines 5.3 to 5.6. We're talking about lines 5.20 to 5.28. Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my only question is if the problem is getting the data released and so that you can get a decent time to get a quote from PEEP, why isn't the bill just to require a specified period of time to release the data to the other carrier?
Representative Ward.
If I understand your question, Representative Hall, it's a timelines issue. Is that what you're saying? Mr. Chair, I don't quite understand the question.
Mr. Chair, what I hear is that most of the folks that testified to the fact that they had trouble getting the claims data. Well, why isn't the bill just to shorten the timeline and require that the claims data be provided in a short period of time so they can get a decent quote?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, and Representative Howell. That's what the clause talks about, is getting the information in a timely, efficient, effective manner so that a proper bid can be gotten. And if you heard one of the testifiers say, they struggle with getting that data information.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Yaruso actually answered the question that I was going to ask, but I do have one quick question, and this is a little bit off topic, but it says 1,000 lives and you can opt out. Is that employee lives or total lives, like spouses?
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Rosenthal, that is insured lives. Insured lives.
Okay, there being no other questions from members of the committee, is there anyone else from the public who is absolutely compelled to testify on Section 4? I mean compelled, moved by the Holy Spirit. Then seeing none, then Representative Ward, I'm sorry, how did we move this? The Chair moves that House File 573 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All in favor to signify by... roll call has been requested. The CLA will call the roll.
Chair Lesh.
Aye.
Vice Chair Allen.
Aye.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Representative Hillsborough.
Aye.
Representative Holberg.
No.
Representative Hortman.
Aye.
Representative Howe.
No.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Weaving.
Aye.
Representative Neuberger?
No.
Representative Paymar?
Aye.
Representative Pugh?
No.
Representative Rosenthal?
Yes.
Representative Simon?
Yes.
Representative Scott?
No.
Representative Rehnquist?
Yes.
Representative Yaruso?
Yes.
Vote being 10-7, the motion does pass. Thank you, Representative Ward. Thank you to your testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Allen. What's that? Who wants to start with A2? Representative Allen moves House File 1082 that it be recommended to pass and sent to Judiciary Finance and Policy. Representative Allen has an A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author so desires. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Well, I guess I can't do it. All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. To your bill as amended, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We also have two other amendments.
Okay.
Oh, those are on the, I'm sorry. Wait, those are on 1081. We're ready.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Allen. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Which bill?
This is House File 1082. The legislator started looking at forfeiture in 2010 following the shutdown of the Metro gang strike force. In 2010 and 2012, the legislature passed two bills that expanded the reporting requirements and made minor incremental changes in the state's forfeiture laws. Because of the improved reporting requirements, we now know more about forfeiture than any other state. The two bills presented today are based on that knowledge and data. House File 1082 deals with defendants. Under administrative forfeiture, defendants must file a civil suit to recover property. 67% of those defendants do not ever file suit. This bill does not change the administrative forfeiture process that prosecutors use when the property is abandoned. If the defendant does file suit, the administrative forfeiture becomes a judicial forfeiture. With respect to controlled substance offenses, current law presumes that the seized property is associated with such crimes, and the owner has the burden of proving it is not. Nothing that happens in the criminal court matters. House File 1082 changes this presumption by requiring prosecutors to prove in civil court that the property is associated with the crime and makes a conviction or admission of guilt a prerequisite for all judicial forfeiture. This bill changes the work of prosecutors, not police officers. No one should lose their property if they are acquitted in criminal court, and under current law, they can. And if two testifiers. First is Mr. Chair is Kelly Keegan from the is it?
I'll go first.
Okay. And leave Mr. McGrath is going first. Mr.
Okay,
Chair.
Mr. McGrath, please introduce yourself for the record, beginning your testimony. We have 14 minutes left in this committee session, Mr. McGrath, so please keep your comments brief.
I will. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lee McGrath. I'm the legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice. Civil forfeiture represents one of the biggest threats to property rights and due process rights in Minnesota today. Between 2003 and 2010, law enforcement seized over $32 million in property in nearly 35,000 forfeiture actions. That is the equivalent of taking property from every resident of the city of Roseville. During that period, the number of forfeiture actions grew by 75%. While the crime rate decreased by more than 15%. This is a statewide issue. In 2003, about a quarter of Minnesota agencies engaged in forfeiture. By 2010, the number had grown to 55%. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll submit the rest of my testimony in writing. I urge you to support Representative Allen's bill, and I thank the many co-authors for joining with her.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Ms. Keegan, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Kelly Keegan. I'm the legislative chair of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. We represent both private practice lawyers and also public defenders. And I'll keep my comments brief as well, but I wanted to address, there's been some opposition testimony that apparently our clients have a very easy venue for fighting these types of forfeiture actions in that they can file a claim in conciliation court. I would argue that that is not an easy venue for someone who's pro se, who represents themselves. It's easy for the lawyers to forget how terrified a client is. I have first appearances with a client, and their only point of being there is to essentially get another date. They don't even need to speak, and they are absolutely petrified. It's a very difficult thing for a person who's pro se to go into court, to represent themselves with the potential of having to cross-examine a cop or a police officer, and to face a person who's with the County Attorneys Association who does this full-time and has a law degree. Not only that, but these are people who a lot of times the criminal case is not a strong case against them, and they may not even be charged. And I hear from them frequently that they don't want to poke the bear, so to speak. They don't want to provoke criminal charges in these types of cases. And so a lot of these people are just leaving their property essentially to forfeiture. And when we have a process that the government has the deck stacked in their favor and that there's a presumption of forfeiture, we need to really take a look at the way we do forfeitures. And the Gang Strike Task Force and some of the other task force have really shed light on some of the problems, some of the abuses with this. We have a forfeiture system that presumes property is gone with the allegation or the accusation of a police officer who stands to financially benefit from that forfeiture decision. I would submit to you that forfeiture is broken, and I really encourage the members to vote in favor of this bill.
Thank you. Did you have any other testifiers, Representative Allen?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Questions from members of the committee. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Will this also cover, it says law enforcement, does this also include game wardens?
Okay. Representative Allen.
It covers all property associated with forfeiture.
Mr. Chair, yes, it covers all property associated with forfeiture.
Okay. Thank you. No other questions, and we have Ms. Peggy Horsch. Let's track one at a time. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Allen, have you talked to any of the county attorneys about this issue at all?
Representative Johnson, that's who's here to testify now.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Horsch, please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Peggy Horsch, and I'm an assistant Dakota County attorney.
Please begin your testimony, Ms. Horsch.
Thank you for having me this morning. I know your time is very brief. I'd like to address the conciliation court comment first. Conciliation court is the court that was designed for the people. I've been in conciliation court presently in our county. I don't attend conciliation court matters on forfeitures. Somebody does from law enforcement. I know it's informal. I know that it's in front of a judge. The judge brings the people up in front of the bench. The judge asks the people questions because the judge wants to get the decision right, too. So I would point that out. I would point out that to file a demand in conciliation court consists of one page when you put down your name, your property, and you ask the court to return it to you. So that's my comment on that. As far as this particular piece of legislation, I would say that this goes beyond the situations where somebody's acquitted of a crime. And I can give you just a very brief example of how this legislation would have impacted this case. And that's James Betts versus the 2000 Denali Cash and a Weapon. In 2011, Mr. Betts was driving a vehicle when he was stopped by the Hastings Police Department. He didn't have a valid license. Inside the vehicle was 40 grams of methamphetamine, a scale, cash, 4 cell phones, a loaded handgun. He was charged with a controlled substance crime, and he was also charged with a felon in possession of a firearm. As part of a plea deal, he pled to the felon in possession of a firearm, and the controlled substance case was dismissed. That's what happens in a lot of these controlled substance cases. People plead guilty to something other than the controlled substance crime. Under this legislation, I would not be able to prove I have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that firearm, the cash, and the vehicle were connected to a controlled substance crime. Under this legislation, because he didn't plead guilty to the controlled substance crime, I would not be able to do that. Presently, clear and convincing evidence is a high standard. I'd have to convince a judge by clear and convincing evidence that that handgun, that cash, and that vehicle was connected to that controlled substance crime. I can't do that under this legislation, so I'd be out. So I think it goes beyond the scope of acquittals. It's not just acquittals. In an acquittal case, a prosecutor would have to look and determine, if this person's been acquitted, do I have clear and convincing evidence to pursue a forfeiture case? And we would do that.
Thank you. Questions from members of the committee? For Ms. Horsch. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And ma'am, wouldn't the gun, first of all, the gun is contraband and the drugs are contraband, so those wouldn't be included here. I mean, those would just be forfeit, period, right?
Ms. Horsch.
Under that scenario?
Under that scenario, he was a felon in possession, so the firearm would have left. But the car and the cash that was found within the, you know, within same car as the methamphetamine, the cell phones, and the other evidence of drug dealing, I wouldn't be able to do anything with that. So, and it also affects buy fund monies, too. Buy fund monies often are found with cash from previous buy funds or from that particular incident. So that buy fund money, if we'd found buy fund money, that would have gone back again to the offender.
Questions from members? Yeah. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, for the county attorney, in a criminal court, you mentioned that where a conviction is clear and convincing evidence. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I'm sorry, Representative. In a criminal court, we have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, which is it's a different standard. And
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, in a civil court, is just the preponderance of the evidence?
Ms. Horsch.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. In this instance, it's clear and convincing evidence, which is more than a preponderance of the evidence. It's a higher burden.
Representative Johnson, do you have another question?
Yes. Reference this bill Mr. Chair, in the forfeiture aspect, this is done in civil court where it requires just the preponderance of evidence.
Ms. Horsch.
Mr. Chair, again, written in this statute is we have to prove by clear and convincing evidence. That's a different standard than preponderance. Preponderance we describe as 51% of the evidence. Clear and convincing is a higher burden than that.
Representative Johnson.
So, Mr. Chair, so this bill takes the forfeiture out of civil court by the definitions what they require and put it into criminal court?
Ms. Horsch.
For standards purposes?
Ms. Horsch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, it's somewhat confusing in that we need a conviction, which is, but it still remains a civil process. And that's one of our problems with this is, you know, we have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case, yet this is still within the civil context of the law.
Representative Urso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm having trouble understanding why, when the prosecutor's office is declining to pursue convicting someone of a crime, we should assume that their property should be confiscated and retained for a crime which is not being prosecuted and no attempt is being made to prove that that crime existed. And also why we should retain the property when not only do we not think that the crime could be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, but also that this property couldn't even be associated with it by clear and convincing evidence. So why should we retain that property under those conditions in this country?
Ms. Horsch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I think there's a couple reasons. First of all, things happen in a criminal process which don't necessarily relate to whether or not that property was connected to a controlled substance crime. As I explained, in this situation, there was a plea bargain. Doesn't mean that he could not have pled to something else, but in this case, we don't have control over that plea bargain. There's cases where people aren't charged and things happen, especially with drug-related and controlled substance crimes where there's informants. Things don't get charged. Things maybe don't go through the criminal process the same way. It doesn't mean that property, the property we're talking about, the property that's been seized, is not connected to a controlled substance crime. All we're asking is for our day in court to be able to show that, to be able to prove by clear and convincing evidence to a judge why this property was associated.
Representative Russo? Representative Holberg?
Mr. Chair, while the county attorney was testifying, Mr. McGrath was shaking his head, and
he
I would just like to
take his turn, Representative Holberg.
What?
Go ahead, Representative.
Well, if he would maybe give his reasons for disagreeing with the testimony.
Well, we'll give him that opportunity at the end. Well, we have other questions for. Mr. McGrath, is there a specific point you wanted to address, keeping in mind that your rebuttal time will probably be at the end in closing comments on the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holberg, the idea, no one is denying the county, the prosecutor, the opportunity to go into civil court. More importantly, it is the county attorney, it is the prosecutor who controls the plea bargaining process. To suggest otherwise, I thought, was misleading, and I apologize for the demonstrative response to that comment.
Thank you. Representative Holberg? Okay. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Urso, part of your comment about why some things don't end up in the criminal court, I myself, working in law enforcement, working as a narcotics investigator, I've done numerous cases where we will find the evidence, find the property, do the forfeiture process, and we'll charge the individual. We'll hold that charge over them to be able to use them as an informant, where if they do not provide the information that we're asking for, and it's their choice whether to provide the information or get charged out, but we're able to go farther up the food chain in the drug investigations and get the more important person. I've had cases go all the way from a little town up by Bram all the way to Houston, Texas, and into Mexico because of being able to use that avenue, but we're still able to punish the person by being able to use the forfeiture process, yet they were never charged out.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Members, unless there are any other comments, we are going to proceed to a vote. Is there anyone else in the audience that is absolutely compelled to testify on House File 1082 as amended? Seeing none, then Representative Allen moves that House File 1082, that it be recommended to pass and sent to Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Next House file, members, 1081, we don't have time to deal with because our committee time is at an end for today. We are going to return at 5:30 to take up that bill prior to Judiciary, meeting at 6 o'clock, and hopefully take a half hour to deal with that. But until then, committee is... We will email you with the room number. Committee is in recess. House Civil Law Committee is back in order. Representative Allen. Representative Allen moves House File 1081 that it be recommended to pass and sent to Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. Do you have amendments on this, Representative Allen?
Yes.
Are they in our packets?
Yep.
Okay. The testifier could get going and, you want to offer all these amendments, Representative Allen? We have three written amendments here, Representative Allen. So which we have A1, A2, and A3. Okay. So the A1 amendment, changing a may to a shall, always a fun grammatical change. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. To your A3 amendment, Representative Allen, I see you're changing blind to ignorant.
which is always an appropriate phrase around here at the Capitol. And then the construction of term. So if you could just briefly state the reason for the Section 15 modification.
I believe it's a more gentle term. It's a more so acceptable term. Really, Mr. McGrath.
Okay, briefly, Mr. McGrath. This is just the amendment, so briefly.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Lee McGrath. There is significant federal case law about willful blindness, and so the Section 15 change references that federal case law, which should help litigants. Know exactly what the parameters of this concept are, even though it has a different name in Minnesota law.
Understood. Okay. Thank you. All in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. So what is the oral amendment, Representative Allen?
The oral amendment, Mr. Chair, is to delete Section 2. Lines 218 through 3.5. It starts on page 2 and page 3.
Okay. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Okay, to your bill as amended, Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 1081 is the Innocent Owner Bill. This bill opens the door to an innocent co-owner of a vehicle and shifts the burden of proof. It deals with the third-party spouse. This bill requires the prosecutor to prove that the third-party spouse is not an innocent owner by showing that she had actual knowledge or was willfully ignorant that the offender would commit a crime that triggers forfeiture. We submit that no spouse should lose his or her vehicle through forfeiture who has not been charged with a crime, and that the government should have the burden of proving the requisite knowledge.
Thank you. Mr. McGrath, please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lee McGrath. I'm the legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice. The government should not have the power, Mr. Chairman, to forfeit a person's property who is not even charged with a crime unless the prosecutor proves that the person consented or knew about the crime. This is the premise of Representative Allen's Bill 1081. We are here today because the premise is not law today. Today, in Minnesota law says that spouses, neighbors, friends are guilty, and you, those people, must prove in civil court your innocence by clear and convincing evidence. This is the very opposite of the idea that people are presumed innocent until proven guilty. And the law's current burden of proof of clear and convincing evidence that is on the claimant, the third party, the spouse, is far higher than what forfeiture opponents who may follow me will complain against in the current bill, where the proposed burden of proof is only preponderance of the evidence. But what is worse, Mr. Chairman, is that in 2009, the Minnesota Supreme Court, in a torturous attempt at statutory interpretation, opined that overcoming the presumption of guilt is not enough for spouses. They don't even have standing to bring a case. In a case called Lasse versus 2007 Chevrolet Tahoe, the Supreme Court locked the doors to the courthouse for all innocent spouses who jointly own their vehicles with their husbands or wives. After the Lasse decision, no spouse in Minnesota can get back property. They are barred from even entering court. By contrast, Mr. Chairman, the law does not treat other third-party claimants that way. Banks, leasing companies, rent-a-car companies can easily get back vehicles that they claim. After the Supreme Court decision, the law only treats spouses that way. For that reason, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I urge you to support House File 1081.
Thank you. Do you have another testifier, Representative Allen?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Please
Mr.
come
Lass.
Forward, whoever that is.
Mr. Lassie.
Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Lassie. I'm the Lassie in the landmark lawsuit, Lassie versus 207 Chevy Tahoe. I live in Cambridge, Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of the House File 1081. I have nothing to gain by being here. I have already lost my $35,000 vehicle, $8,000 in legal expenses, and I can't get them back. I'm here for only one reason. I do not want what happened to me to happen to another Minnesota. Here's the history of my case. The district court ruled in my favor. It said I did not have the necessary level of knowledge. It ruled I was an innocent owner. The Court of Appeals agreed and said I was an innocent owner. But I lost at the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said nothing different than the lower courts about whether I knew about the crime, but then it moved the goalposts. The Supreme Court found that my not having any knowledge about the crime was not enough for me to get my vehicle back. Instead, the Supreme Court said that because my wife Jean was guilty of crime, I was guilty of the same crime. By this standard, I was found not to be an innocent owner, even though I was asleep at the time the crime occurred. More importantly, no spouse in Minnesota will be considered an innocent owner when they have the same facts as me. I'm happy to discuss the facts of my wife's criminal case, my civil case that I fought for more than 3 years. I have said you vote for the House File 1081. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lassie, for your testimony. Any other testifiers, Representative Allen?
No, Mr. Chair, but I fail to mention that we have been working with the Department of Public Safety, and that was one of the reasons we deleted Section 2, and that I'm committed to working with them on the ignition interlock device, the technical details, which is Section 8, paragraph B on page 9.
Sure. Thank you for that. So are there any testifiers in opposition?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
I'm here to testify in favor also.
We'll keep some time for people to testify afterwards. I'm going to take opposition on the list right now, and if you want to testify in favor, you can do it afterwards. I have Peggy Horsch. Peggy Horsch is not here. Okay.
Mr. Chair, may I approach?
Oh.
Sean McCarthy from the County Attorneys Association. I'm an assistant county attorney in Dakota County, where Ms. Horsch works. She was unable to be here. I'm here in her stead.
Okay, well, go have a seat then.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Sean, S-E-A-N, McCarthy, M-C-C-A-R-T-H-Y. I'm assistant Dakota County attorney.
Thank you. Proceed.
I've had experience in both the DWI context with the Attorney General's office for 10 years, 5 years as a city attorney where I was in charge of civil forfeitures for both of the cities that we prosecuted for, and specifically now at the Dakota County Attorney's Office. The position of the County Attorneys Association and of prosecutors throughout the state of Minnesota is that this bill does not in fact advance the interests of simplifying a process or protecting rights. What it really does is it eliminates the forfeiture process and undoes the protections that are the goal of removing the instrumentality of the crime and protecting the public by removing that from the hands of the criminal. It undermines that goal significantly. This prosecution position would be that the use of the concept of willful ignorance or willful blindness is a concept from federal case law that has never been used in Minnesota. There is no case law on it. There's no statutory definition here for it, and it's completely unworkable. What it creates is a virtually impossible burden for a prosecutor to establish whether or not a person knew or didn't know what was going on in a particular incident.
Instead, it ignores the fact that, for example, in a DWI context, it is incredibly common for someone who's got multiple DWIs to not be able to get a loan or not be able to get title to a vehicle. So what do? They turn to their spouse or their brother or their girlfriend and ask, hey, can you sign on this loan for me? Can you buy this car for me? I'll pay for everything. You just need to sign here so that it's taken care of. DWI offender after DWI offender, especially the repeat offenders, the ones who are the most dangerous on our roadways, those are the ones that this forfeiture law originally, the earlier version that's being proposed to be changed here, is designed to protect. The proposals here would remove those protections by essentially making it virtually impossible for a prosecutor to forfeit the vehicle. The county's position is that the lack of a clear standard in the concept of willful ignorance, coupled with the shifting of the burden, currently the way that the burden is set up in the existing law, if a person is an innocent owner, they can allege just that. They have an opportunity to get into court on that. In Mr. Loss's situation that he just testified, excuse me, Lossie's situation that he just testified about, the county's position would be as prosecutors that for Mr. Lossie, there's a misreading of the case to suggest that the court in his case intended to ask the legislature to completely rewrite the law. In fact, there was a specific reference that one sentence here that from the court opinion says, if you want to allow a spouse to be able to assert an innocent owner defense, all you need to say is, if the vehicle is jointly owned, the owner, who is not the offender, may assert the innocent owner defense. That fix right there takes care of everything Mr. Lossie was just testifying about, that one sentence. Instead, what we have is a complete shifting of the burdens in a way that is fundamentally different from any way Minnesota courts have previously dealt with or Minnesota statute has previously dealt with this. And it ignores the fact then that what it really does is it provides a roadmap or instruction booklet for persons who are committing crimes to keep the instrumentality of their crime, whether it be a vehicle in a DWI case or the proceeds of the crime, such as money in the situation of a drug dealer. A case that does a nice job of illustrating this, Christopher DeLong versus 2003 Volkswagen. This is a case from my county. Law enforcement in that case were contacted by a citizen that a driver was passed out behind the wheel while the vehicle was running on an off-ramp of 35E. Mr. DeLong was found behind the wheel, and with him in the car were large bundles of marijuana, individual baggies of marijuana, packaged ready to sell, empty Ziploc baggies, freshly smoked marijuana, drug paraphernalia. He stated to police that he was in St. Cloud and was traveling back to the Twin Cities, and he specifically told the officers he owned the vehicle, but his mom happens to be on the title because of a loan issue that he was having a hard time getting a loan. At trial, mom testified that her name's on the title, but she only co-signed so that her son could get the car. She had never driven the vehicle, did not have keys, never went into the car, never so much as put gas in the car, got an oil change, never made payment on a loan. Her son paid the loan in record time. His drug enterprises gave him some opportunities there. She specifically testified she had no knowledge of her son's drug dealing or reason to know he was dealing drugs. In that case, clearly, that's his car. That's the purpose of the forfeiture law, is to take that car that allows him to be a drug dealer away from him. And any money found in the car, the current forfeiture law is designed to allow us to take that money away from him. He's the drug dealer. His mom actually owned two other cars, including a Kia. Under the proposed version that this bill offers, all that would have to happen here is the mother would come in with a vehicle registration to show that her name is on as an owner. And automatically, the state would have to prove that she had no idea her son was involved in drug activity. Otherwise, the car goes back, and guess who the car is going to go back to? Go back to him. Guess who the drug money is going to go back to? It's going to go back to him. To convolute the existing forfeiture process by adding unworkable definitions and shifting burdens in a way that runs contrary to the goal of the forfeiture laws, the prosecution and the counties would present that that is an inappropriate way to go forward with this issue.
Questions from members? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
In the case that you just laid out with the Volkswagen, why wouldn't the court, could they just say that the bill or that the vehicle is given back to the mom and it will remain in her possession?
That's not what Mr.
the bill says. Okay. Mr. Mr. McCarthy, go ahead.
That's not what this bill says. The bill says the car is returned to the owner. But in this case, on this record, with the mom there, does she have any interest in driving or wanting that car? No. She bought this, or she signed a paper so that her son could pay for, drive, possess, and use this car.
Representative Scott.
If money was still, thank you, Mr. Chair, if money was still owed on it, if he hadn't paid it off, wouldn't she want the vehicle back?
Mr. McCarthy.
That's not what was the case in this case.
So could it be
a person could always want the money?
Mr. McCarthy, go through the chair. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Couldn't that be the case, though? I mean, would what would change if there was money owed on that vehicle and she wanted to sell it to pay off her loan? Her
Mr. McCarthy.
I think the best way to answer that is to compare it with the drug situation. Let's say there's $10,000 in the car with him. Clearly drug proceeds because of everything else that you heard about that case. Under this bill, that $10,000 goes back to her. What is she going to do with that $10,000? Give it back to him. She has no rights to that $10,000.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. McCarthy. So, you know, you sketch out a compelling set of facts, but and I'd have to think about it more in terms of how this bill would apply to those facts. I take you at your word, but I guess my question is, how common is that set of facts? I mean, we have the gentleman here. I'm sorry, I forgot his name, the namesake of the case, the Supreme Court case,
Mr. Lossie,
and then we have what you're describing. They are, in some people's minds, mine, namely, equally compelling for opposite reasons. I have to think there's some middle ground here. I don't know if tonight is the time to do it, but, you know, it seems to me we don't want to... There's got to be something that can accommodate both fact situations. My question to you, there is a question here, Mr. Chair. The question is, how common is the type of fact situation that you presented? I'm going to ask the same thing of the other side as well.
Mr. McCarthy.
As a prosecutor who has appeared in court multiple times on forfeiture challenges, they come up, it really boils down to two issues: ownership and whether or not the thing being forfeit is innocent or not, whether or not the car is really the car of the person who's claiming to own it, and whether they're truly an innocent owner with clean hands, so to speak. The biggest issue is ownership, and the bill as presented to the committee shifts the burden so that it's presumed to be the innocent owner, and they're presumed to be innocent. The problem with that is the arguments you heard earlier seem to focus on, and in this country, nobody's guilty until innocent. This isn't about guilt or innocence. This is about protecting the public by removing vehicles from the hands of drunk drivers, removing drug proceeds from drug sales and whatnot. To answer your question directly, this is an incredibly common scenario. The person who's got their second or third DWI knows, because they've been given specific warnings in their prior court appearances, and it's part of every single DWI plea petition, that those prior DWI convictions can be used to enhance future convictions, and that enhancement can lead to higher criminal sentences, plate impoundment, and vehicle forfeiture. Every DWI that I've stood up in court and had that kind of a plea petition go in warns people of that. So by the time you're on your second or your third, you start thinking, hey, what should I be doing here in terms of putting my car in somebody else's name?
You know, I don't want to go on with a philosophical discussion because I don't have amendment language to offer. The question I want to ask Mr. McCarthy is, if the test should not be mere ownership, if you're saying that goes too far the other way because of the example that you sketched out, what about a test that is somehow based on common everyday use? If in your example the mother had put gas in, did regularly drive it, did bring it in for an oil change, had some regular use of it, do you think a test along those lines, I have no amendment language, I'm just asking you what your opinion is, do you think a test along the line of actual everyday use would be better, preferable to one based only on ownership?
Mr. McCarthy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I don't know that you need amendment language, because the existing law does exactly that. It creates a rebuttable presumption, and the prosecution can come forward with affirmative evidence, like the kind of evidence I sketched in this case. And a judge can hear that evidence and also hear the evidence from any alleged innocent owner and balance that in case by case, determine, is this a truly innocent owner or not? What is their ownership role, and what is their relative role in terms of whether or not they have clean hands in the dealing overall? Again, that's my, the whole point here is this particular bill convolutes a system that has worked well and that has helped fund law enforcement, fund prosecution purposes, and particularly has also helped remove vehicles from the hands of people that drive dangerously.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the question I have is, some of the issues have been brought up about the banking institution, the loans on the vehicles. It's a two-fold question. One, is it the current law that if the vehicle is forfeited, that the person or the owner is still liable for those loan issues? And two, is it normally given back to the banks to offset the costs to the rest of the public to keep the loan values down for everybody else?
What are you asking that question of, Representative Johnson? Mr. McCarthy, are you qualified to answer that question?
My understanding is yes and yes, Your Honor. Or Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Well, could you,
Representative Winkler?
Could you just maybe state that in a fuller form?
Narrative for us, please.
Representative Winkler is requesting full sentences. I prefer the short ones, just for the record.
You're the chair. I go with what you want. I can explain a little bit, I guess.
Please, very briefly. We're running low on time, so.
If there is a loan, the loan is still the contractual responsibility of the individual who signed that loan contract. Frequently, if there's any kind of a buyback, an agreement reached between the prosecution and the defendant or the vehicle owner, the alleged innocent owner, frequently those agreements include specific language such as we're going to work in money to pay for what's owed on the loan, or alternatively there's going to be some arrangement made to finance that. And specifically that the offender shall not touch, shall not have hands on, shall not drive that vehicle.
I believe, Representative Winkler, my understanding is that the owner is liable for the loan, and losses are mitigated for the bank by the value of the vehicle, which of course they assess very lowly, I'm sure. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to say that listening to some of your testimony, I don't know if we're just talking past each other, but, you know, the idea that this funds law enforcement is, to me, a reason not to do it. I think there's fundamentally something very wrong with funding law enforcement by grabbing people's property. I think that's very wrong. And I think the law is even worse than it used to be, because now prosecutors get a cut. And I think that's really troubling. This is policing for profit, and to a degree it's also prosecuting for profit. And to me, that even if there is no wrongdoing on the part of either police or prosecutors, I think it really stinks when people look at it. Incentives are real. And most of us don't think incentives affect our behavior. We think it affects other people's behavior. But the public looking at this, I think, has reason to be very suspicious that that this is not always being done for the right reasons. Now, going back a little bit, you made a statement, this isn't about punishment. But for Mr. Lossie, this is punishment. He lost a car, $35,000 car. He didn't do anything. Now, you can say it's not punishment. I would guess he feels punished. So I think that that's just absolutely outrageous, for even though I realize I'm a lawyer too, I know that formally speaking it's not punishment, but the reality is that it is punishment. And then in the situation even that you mentioned, which I think is, you can say, okay, the car will go back to him or the money will go back to him, so you say. I think as a prosecutor, it would be your burden to go in there and say, this woman took out the loan and you prove that she took out the loan to give a car to somebody that she had reason to believe was going to use it for illegal purposes, and then she would lose the car. But that should be your burden to show. You know, just be, you can sit here and say, oh, those were the facts. Well, we don't know those were the facts. And in any given case, the facts are what somebody proves them to be in court. And I think it's entirely reasonable to put on the prosecution at least the burden of showing by a preponderance of the evidence that this person is not innocent. So I have to say, when we talk in this committee, and a member made this comment before on the previous bill, that this is, punishing people who engage in illegal behavior. Punishment is supposed to be what a judge imposes after a conviction. Punishment is not supposed to be grabbing somebody's property and making them come and show that it shouldn't be grabbed. So that's just my comment.
Representative Russo, and members, the intention was, if there were questions for Mr. McCarthy. If your question is not for Mr. McCarthy, Representative Russo, I'm going to ask Mr. Keller to come up here. And I believe the State Patrol wanted to testify as well, and we're at the end of the meeting. So, Representative Russo.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And it is, actually, for him. The question hinges for me on the issue of in whose favor should the rebuttable presumption go. Should it go to the state, or should it go to the owner of the property? And a moment ago, you used the phrase, the alleged innocent owner. And I would like to hear what, in your mind, is the difference between calling them the alleged innocent owner and the presumed innocent owner.
Mr. McCarthy.
The current bill before the committee, if I may respond, shifts the burden of proof. The concept of a prima facie showing of ownership is all that's required to make that shift happen. If your name's on the title, you're presumed an innocent owner. That's the way that this bill shifts it. In fact, in Rife versus 1987 Chevy Cavalier, a case that specifically deals with this issue, the court confirmed that all a person would, that the concept of prima facie proof is coming forward with something showing that you have an ownership interest in the vehicle.
Representative Urso. Okay, thank you. Representative Hobart.
I'll pass.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Keller.
Thank you.
Please,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please be brief.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I want to address the issue of ownership because that seems to be where the issue is joined here. My name is Max Keller. I'm a criminal defense attorney. I'm here speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Mr. McCarthy and I worked together for 5 years in the Attorney General's office, and like him, I've been to court on many criminal cases and many forfeitures. It seems as if the county attorney's office, County Attorney's Association's objections voiced through Mr. McCarthy go to the definition of ownership. That's why I got my iPad out here. I'm not doing Facebook like some people do in these committee hearings. I actually looked up the definition of ownership here because I wanted to speak to this. In 169A.63, as it's currently written, the current law, the DWI forfeiture statute, in subdivision 1, the definitions, ownership is currently defined, and I think it's important to see how it's defined. It's subdivision 1, paren H, is the definition of owner. It says, owner means a person legally entitled to possession, use, and control of a motor vehicle, including a lessee. It goes on, talks about lessees, and it says, there's a rebuttable presumption that a person registered as the owner of a motor vehicle, according to the records of the Department of Public Safety, is the legal owner. For purposes of this section, if a motor vehicle is owned jointly by two or more people, each owner's interest extends to the whole of the vehicle and is not subject to apportionment. Now, that last sentence is the problem with the Lasse case, is that the Minnesota Supreme Court said you can't split the baby in half, and so basically when one co-owner is innocent and the other one is not innocent, we're not going to do anything for Mr. Lasse, which is an error by the Minnesota Supreme Court, because of course a property like that is divisible because you could sell it and you could split the proceeds at worst, but a I wanted to speak to what the County Attorney's Association is saying, because they're saying there's a problem with ownership. There's no problem with ownership, because this bill here, House File 1081, does not change the definition of ownership. The County Attorney's Association, the Dakota County Attorney's Office, they have every ability in each individual case, as Representative Liebling just said, to go in and argue the facts of that particular case to say, Mr. Keller is not really an owner. He doesn't have any standing to make an innocent owner defense in this case, because he's just a nominal owner. His name just got put on the title so that he could get a loan. He never drove the car. This other person made the payments. He never touched the car. He never went in the car. The car wasn't kept at his house. It has nothing to do with that. So this bill does not change the definition of ownership. And Mr. McCarthy, through the County Attorneys Association, is basically setting up a straw man and saying there's some problem with ownership. This bill does not change the current definition of ownership. And that's the definition, basically, that we're operating under right now. The problem is the rest of the law that's being reformed by this bill and is very much in need of reform. You know, the county attorneys, for instance, in Scott County, I've been there for a forfeiture. Scott County prosecutors brag that two-thirds of people don't even challenge their forfeitures. A bunch of those people are innocent owners. And Representative Liebling correctly says that technically this is not punishment, but actually the U.S. Supreme Court and the Minnesota Supreme Court have both recognized that forfeiture actually is in part punitive. It has a remedial purpose too, but they say that it doesn't violate the double jeopardy clause, and it's not excessive fines, although it is punitive. So they do recognize that, and surely it is very punitive to somebody like Mr. Lossie, and these people are being shut out of court right now, and I've had many clients like that, and to work this harm to innocent co-owners when in many cases these are spouses or other relatives, parents of criminal defendants, when they've said to these people, you know, Max, you need to go and get treatment, or, you know, Max, we paid for your legal fees, and now these people, innocent owners, are left basically having their property taken away from them when they've done everything to maybe prevent a crime from being committed, and they've told their relative to go out and get treatment, and the person takes the keys anyway without them knowing it, commits another DWI, or has 1 gram of cocaine, some minimal amount, they're not a drug dealer, and they get their property taken away from them. It's not fair. So that's why the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers does support this bill. So we would urge the committee to adopt it.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. Testify from the Minnesota State Patrol. Please,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please take a seat, introduce yourself for the record, and proceed with your testimony.
Nancy Silkey, Minnesota State Patrol Major. I'll be very brief, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to just briefly express some concerns and a request for clarity. DPS has had previous communications with advocates of the bill, and we have spoken to the author briefly and appreciate willingness to work to address concerns. I will be very brief addressing the concerns related to implementation and operational challenges for that and request for clarity for the committee in regards to the bill language and the ignition interlock. We believe forfeiture has had value, yet DPS has also met with bill advocates to hear their position and intent of the bill. So if the legislature determines a change in the forfeiture procedures, we would certainly work with those involved and suggest options for consideration for implementation procedures. Specifically, DPS is concerned about many unanswered procedural questions related to ignition interlock that would make implementation very challenging and likely result in inconsistencies throughout the state if not clarified. We would request some clarification so that there isn't confusion on the process and so that there would be clarity on the roles and responsibilities and accountability as far as who would administer the program. Currently, as I understand it, DBS has informed me that ignition interlock is correlated to a person currently, and in this bill it ties it to the vehicle. So if law enforcement were to stop a vehicle that had been court ordered to have ignition interlocked, there's no mechanism in place to notify law enforcement so that they could check or even know that the court had ordered it. And currently that system exists with DBS or through DBS managing that program. And I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee and the ability to work with Representative Allen.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Major Silkey. And I would note for members that this bill is going to Judiciary, where I think it has an uphill climb. So that noted. Are there other questions from members for the author? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has a fiscal note been requested? Because obviously if this happens, then there will be a lack of forfeited items that the counties and the local units of government are accumulating, and they'll have to make up for that somewhere, I'm presuming.
Can any of you testify to that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee and the Senate,
Mr. McGrath.
Senator Thompson, the author of the Senate version, has requested a fiscal note on the bill.
Okay, thank you. Other questions from members? Seeing none, then Representative Allen renews her motion that House File 21, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to Judiciary, Finance, and Policy. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no.
No.
Motion passes. Thank you. There being no other business before the committee today, we'd advance, right? Yes. Committee is adjourned. Thank you, members.